We got to address the suburban women problem because it's real.
Suburban women helped determine the 2020 election, but there's more to us than the headlines would have you believe.
The suburbs aren't a homogenous sea of white people in perfect houses. Real change is happening in the suburbs, and we have things to say.
When women share their personal stories, walls come down and barriers are broken.
Welcome to the Suburban Women Problem, a podcast from Red, Wine, and Blue.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for listening. I'm Jasmine Clark.
I'm Amanda Weinstein.
And I'm Katie Paris, filling in for Rachel Vindman, who is out on a very exciting book tour with her husband, Alex.
Today, we'll be speaking with Meredith Lawson Rowe, a suburban mom from Ohio who won her local race for city council alongside a group of other amazing women who call themselves the Women of Reynoldsburg. And after that, I sit down with Christina Reynolds, the VP of Communications with Emily's List and author of a brand new book, Run to Win, Lessons in Leadership for Women Changing the World. Emily's List supports women running for office, and that means challenging sexism, not only from men, but also in ourselves, which can be hard to talk about. You know, we've internalized a lot of lessons about what women can or can't do and what we should or shouldn't be. So, Katie, you've been working in politics for a while now. How did it feel to be one of the only women in the room?
This is honestly kind of, I'm feeling kind of vulnerable. This is sort of embarrassing to admit. Thankfully, I'm in a very different place today. But early on in my career, I looked at politics just like any other industry, right? It's dominated by men. But rather than seeing that as a problem, I saw it as like, a badge of honor that like I'm part of the boys' club, you know, that I'm getting accepted within this. You know, I saw that as like, aren't I cool for being one of the women who is a part of the boys' club? Back then, man, I didn't even realize it, but I thought it was cool. I thought that women, you know, maybe they were going to bring the drama. So wasn't I cool to be able to be a part of the boys' club that was drama free somehow, which is not true.
Exactly.
You know, and where did I even get that idea? Like, where did I get these ideas that they're women, drama, caddy, men were without that? Like, honestly, looking back, a lot of drama there.
Oh, yeah.
Where do we get these ideas?
I don't know. If you watch The Bachelor and Bachelorette, as I do, you will realize when it's The Bachelorette, oh, those men have a ton of drama. I would even argue more than when it's The Bachelor.
Exactly.
And honestly, now working with, you know, the team at Red, White, and Blue is all women. It is not high drama. The opposite is true of what we somehow learn, that women are going to bring that, when in fact, women are like, I'm here. I'm going to speak truthfully. I'm going to speak really honestly. We're going to have an exchange of ideas and challenge each other, and then we're going to get shit done.
Yeah. That's been my experience because I, you know, being a legislator, I'm definitely in a male-dominated, you know, a male-dominated rooms where there's very few women, and especially Black women. And I specifically, I've talked about this on the podcast before, you know, I stood up to men in the room, you know, just speaking so inappropriately about women. And I took it far enough that, you know, I actually filed a complaint. And one of the things that I learned in that experience is that maybe people, even women, internalize misogyny to the point where they're like, don't ruffle feathers. It's good enough that we're in here. But if you start ruffling feathers, they're just going to make our lives harder. They're going to retaliate. And it's already hard enough for us. So I really felt like I was up against both men and women who had internalized the misogyny as well when I decided to stand up to, you know, inappropriate talk in our workplace. They would even use the term, this is a good old boys club. This is the way it's always been. And I'm like,
That's okay. Like, that's a positive thing.
Yeah. So I do think that there are, like, to your point, Katie, I think that there are people who feel like when they get into those spaces, they don't want to be loud and too present, because then someone might discover, oh no, like, there's a woman in here. And
who let her in?
Yeah. How did she get here? So, you know, there are people who are just like, if we want to get stuff done, we have to play along to get along.
Which I don't think is true. Like, if you think about the boys club that we talk about, what we don't talk a lot about with the boys club is it's super inefficient, right? We should be ruffling feathers, because this boys club where you're joking and like harassing people. And like, I think of like Mad Men, right? Where they're just drinking alcohol all day, like literally drinking liquor and smoking all day. Do we think that's an efficient workplace where you're drinking liquor and smoking all day? No. Women come into the room like, oh, it's so funny. I thought you guys were in here like doing your job. No, you're not doing that, right? Maybe we could do our job now. So as an economist, most of the rooms I'm in are almost all men. There's been a lot of research about how toxic that environment can be for women, from men, sexual harassment, that whole, you know, everything that you've talked about, Jasmine, same thing in the field of economics. But there's also research that shows male-dominant environments specifically pit women against each other. So when we tell women, hey, if you want to succeed, act like a man, right? Take charge, be aggressive, get your ideas out there. But when women do that, it's specifically other women will put those women in their place for acting outside their gender role kind of constraints. But it's also a way that women distance themselves from other women, right? I'm like you guys. I'm one of the boys. And that's how you get ahead. And that's because of the environment you're in. Sometimes we kind of blame women for doing this incivility, not realizing that it's kind of the waters that they swim in. It's the environment created by other men. I think knowledge is power. Like for me, reading that research, when I have felt something was uncivil or less civil than I would have preferred it from another woman in the room or in an email, part of me, just knowing that research, kind of just lets it go, right?
I think for me, it has been, and this is maybe just always true in terms of the things that form me in my life, but it has been personal experiences of women along the way who have taken that extra time and energy to play that mentoring role. And I don't think that I saw that early on in my career, but when I look back, it was women who were giving me the opportunity to do more if I wanted it. And oh man, did I want it. What woke me up to see that that had happened along the way for me was actually the experience of mentoring someone else, but not realizing I was doing it. So I think I had this experience where a woman who was younger than me worked for me, and I, you know, was trying to do, I think, the things that I had learned from some other women by that point in my career, including her in meetings. She didn't necessarily have to be in, but that she could learn from. I didn't realize what I was doing until she said to me, thank you. And that was like my aha moment. Like, oh, wait, other women have done that for me too. She helped me unlearn in a way, you know, that it was, that it's always about this sort of scarcity approach of, you know, me just seizing any opportunity I could along the way. No, actually, women could support women, and that I had that capacity to do that for other women. And when I did, there's no zero sum. Suddenly the scarcity, I don't know, it's like it melted away. It made strategic sense to include her in that way.
I think that's really interesting, because you're talking about learning from someone who is not like a CEO or your senior or your boss, but learning from people below you. And if you think about, there aren't a lot of women CEOs. So if women are only learning from the people above us, we don't have a lot to learn from, right? But we don't need a CEO to learn from, right? We can learn from each other. I think I've learned, kind of similar to you, I've learned the most from people who are either at my same level or who are brand new starting out. And I've learned a lot just seeing what they do. So a lot of what we do as an economist is we have to convince policymakers. So we go into this room, which typically is mostly men, because mostly men are policymakers, and I have to sit there and I'm going to convince this room of men to do the policy that I think is good for the economy. And there was one room I was in where I walked in, it was actually mostly women. And it was a grant I was working on with a colleague. And I got up and I did my usual speech. And my fallback in a room full of men is usually data and statistics. I hammer home the data. I hammer home the statistics. I had convinced every man in that room. I didn't convince the women. And I was kind of surprised, like, come on, you should be on my side. And I had a colleague Emily, who's a sociologist, but I was watching kind of how she did things very differently. And this is the same project, right? She focused on the intuition, what it meant to families, what it meant to children. And so I've learned a lot just by watching her that we need that data and statistics, but we also need the intuition and the real meaning for families and children and our communities.
When it comes to our mentees basically mentoring us, I think about my daughter. I talk about my daughter a lot on the podcast because she's like my little hero. You know, I bring her along with me to meetings, and I bring, when we, before COVID, she would come to the Capitol with me sometimes too, and she would see me in action. And if you were to ask her today, like, you know, what are you going to be when you grow up? She'll be like, I'm going to be a president. And so I realized that one of the ways we unlearn things is just by showing a different way. And I think that the generation coming up behind us is going to see things very differently than maybe we saw them and our parents saw them and our grandparents saw them. So let's talk to another mom who ran for office and won, in part because of the support she had from other women in her community. And in fact, from other women on the same ballot as her. Meredith, welcome to the podcast.
I am so excited.
Hey, Meredith. It is so awesome to have you on. You have got to share what I already know about the incredible feat that you and the other football moms or the women of Reynoldsburg pulled off in your town, which was formerly a quite conservative suburban area. Tell us how you did that.
First of all, thank you so much for having me here on the show. It's quite a high honor to be amongst you fabulous ladies. So in Reynoldsburg, which was a formerly Republican stronghold suburb of Columbus, Ohio, if you're not familiar, just on the east side, this lady named Kristen Bryant had decided that she was going to run for office because she was tired of not having a choice on the ballot. And in 19, she said, here, I am going to put a full slate of Democrats together, which had never been done in the history of Reynoldsburg. And so I, along with several other candidates from the mayor all the way down to little old me running for a ward seat, we ran and started a blue wave. And so there were two other women that were running right alongside with me who were first-time candidates who we all met in the community because our kids played football together. And so we ran as a slate. We ran as a team. And so we did everything together. We held one another accountable. We had our own group chat. We would make sure everybody knew what was on the calendar. We knocked doors together. There was one time I was to knock with the mayoral candidate, and I was tired. I had come home from work, and I was bummed. And I took my shoes off, and I sat down, and I saw that it was raining. I said, yes, I'm off the hook. It's raining. And she called me and said, where are you? I said, well, it's raining over here. She said, not over here. Come on.
I love that. I definitely understand that feeling of having support. It gives you just that little extra oomph or that motivation. Campaigning is hard. And to have people to talk to about when you're having that day where you're just feeling a little like, I need someone to like talk me through this. I need someone to pump me up. And so I'm very interested in hearing just your experience of that being like an all women cast, like just your support system being just like a group of strong women. I wonder how much different my campaign would have been if I had something like that. So can you speak to that?
Oh, yes. It was very empowering just to be around other strong women, other passionate women, and just, you know, bad A women that just know how to roll up their sleeves and get the work done.
So, Meredith, correct me if I'm wrong, but you all were collectively like the first Black women ever elected to your positions in Reynoldsburg. Is that right?
Yes, we are the first Black women to serve in city council. Madam Angie President is the first Black woman president. I think she's the first woman president of council. Shaunette Strickland is the first Black woman to represent her ward. And I am the first Black woman to represent my ward. So we brought a lot of history, but it's not about being the first. the door has been flung open so that there's others that will come behind us, so that others know that it's possible. And with a little blood, sweat, and tears, you can do it.
So Meredith, one thing we've been talking about on the podcast, though, is that sometimes we as women, and maybe we're not even conscious of it, we don't always support each other. And so what made you choose to see this as not a zero-sum game? Like, you could have thought, you know what? My town has never elected a Black woman to this position before. I got this on my own. I'm going to try to go this.
I'm going
to
be the one.
I'm going to be the one. What made you not see it that way? Or did you ever look at things that way, maybe in your past? And how did you get to where you are?
For me, I didn't see it for myself. I was there to help someone else. I'm the person that likes to do the behind scenes work. And I was encouraged to run. I said, no, not me. I'll help whoever you get. And others believed in me and sort of pushed me to the forefront. I've always been involved in community activities, church activities. And so this gives me just a wider platform in order to serve. A lot of times we as women, we want to have all of our I's dotted, all of our T's crossed, and say, almost like, I'll go to church when I get right, or I'll go work out in the gym when I lose a little bit of weight. Well, we have to start somewhere. We have to start where we are. Amelia Sykes, first time I heard that statement that you must ask a woman seven times, is our minority leader in the Ohio House. And so everybody, run for office, 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 run for office. Okay, you've been asked seven times. So when someone asks you, even if you feel like you're not ready or you're not enough, you are. And once you have a support system as your family or your group of girlfriends or other electeds or candidates, you can do it. You can do it.
So I have a question for you about your football moms. So we know moms, great experiences, but wear lots of different hats, right? No mom out there says, man, I'm so not busy. I have so much free time to like do stuff, right? So one big challenge you have is how do you get the football moms to show up, right? How do you get them to make room in their schedule to show up to a meeting or to knock on doors or, you know, to show up to a board meeting? How do you do that? How did you engage women like that?
Awesome question, Amanda. So football moms, it's so funny. It all begins with relationships because we were sitting in the stands cheering on our kids. And all of us had formed a relationship and a bond because we had spent so much time together at football practices, traveling to football games. And so the core of it all were our kids and our relationship.
You are a magical person, Meredith. I mean, just like it just seems like your natural impulse is to support other women. I have felt that myself.
Absolutely. I have not known Meredith for years. I've only known Meredith for a few minutes. But in this very short time, you're magnetic. Just, I don't know. This is an amazing interview, Meredith. It's so nice to e-meet you or virtually meet you or pod meet you. I don't know what the correct verbiage is for meeting someone on a podcast, but this has been amazing. Thank you so much for being with us today and for all the great work that you're doing.
Oh, such a high honor, first of all, to meet you. I lived in Georgia for about 10 years. All three of my kids are Georgia peaches. So yes, I would also like to say that those of us that actually show up and we are outside of our comfort zones and we show our vulnerability, we open others' eyes to another form of beauty, if you will. Like 20 years ago, it was not, you know, in fashion to have natural, coiled, twisted, braided locks, braids, afros. And now today we have the Crown Act. And I think now we as a society are saying, it's okay to be you and show up as your authentic self. And so keep sharing those experiences to tell people that we are more alike than we are different.
Oh my goodness. I literally, when I decided to go natural and, you know, stop straightening my hair with chemicals because my hair rejected it anyway and it still didn't want to be straight. The number of people that told me I would never be able to get a job the number of people that told me that it was unattractive. They would use words like nappy, unkempt. There was a fear that, you know, me being my authentic self would not be accepted by the world. And I kind of was just like, look, I'm tired of spending 6 or 7 hours in a salon. Like, I just really want to reclaim that time. So you are definitely right in that sharing your experiences and being your authentic self is, it's an eye-opening experience, not just for yourself, but for others around you. Thank you very much, Meredith, for being with us today. And stick around, everyone, for my interview with Christina Reynolds coming up after the break.
Vaccines, mask mandates, kids going back to school, the Delta variant. There's a lot of misinformation out there, and it can be hard to know what to think. So let's talk about it. And lucky for us, one of our hosts is even a microbiologist. You can be part of the conversation by sending your COVID questions and worries to us at theswppod@redwine.blue. Thanks for listening and enjoy the rest of the episode.
Our guest today is the Vice President of Communications for Emily's List, the amazing organization that works hard to elect Democratic women to office. She recently co-wrote the book Run to Win: Lessons in Leadership for Women Changing the World. Christina Reynolds, welcome to the Suburban Women Problem.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here. I love the podcast, but I'm particularly excited to be on with someone who's been endorsed by Emily's List.
I know. So let's start with that. I am an Emily's List candidate. Emily's List supported me in 2018 in my first run, and then they supported me again in 2020 when I had to run again, and I will definitely be applying for an endorsement in 2022 as well, because I truly do love what Emily's List does for women candidates out there, the amount of support that you show to women that have decided to make the ultimate decision to run for office, which is not an easy decision to make. So could you let other listeners know, because I know, but could you let our listeners know a little bit more about Emily's List and what Emily's List mission is?
Sure. And thank you for the opportunity to talk about it. Emily's List is an organization that aims to elect Democratic pro-choice women in offices up and down the ballot all across the country. And the reason that we exist, you know, every now and again, I'll post something about elect women or something like that on Facebook. And I always get someone who replies, well, what about electing the most qualified candidate? And our response is, we are. But the reality is our systems have not been set up for women. Our systems have been created by and for the people who have led this country for way too long, which is overwhelmingly white, overwhelmingly male. And we believe that our government works best when it actually represents the people it represents, when all of the voices are at the table. We also know that, you know, and statistics back this up, women get more done. You introduce more bills. We work more across the aisle. We just get more stuff done. So we're for electing women for that sense. But we want to level the playing field. We know that our women can stand on their own. We just think they sometimes need a little help because the establishment, even of the Democratic Party, but our governments, they're not set up for women. Even voters are not always prepared to see women in leadership roles. And so we want to help make that happen. We do that by recruiting women, although I will say lately we haven't had to go out very far. Women are coming to us, which is fantastic. We recruit women to run. We train them. We do everything from online. We have an online training center to in-person trainings to helping train staff. We try and help them build their campaigns and help them along the way. We help them raise money. We help them learn how to raise money for themselves. And we also try and highlight the challenges that women face, because the reality is a lot of them are inherent in our thinking. They're biases that we don't even know we have. You know, when we say, oh, that Hillary Clinton, let's say, you know, that woman sounds shrill. Or when we ask ourselves if a woman is likable enough to get elected, we're doing that because those women don't fit what we're used to. And so we at Emily's List want to help show people why women are candidates. You know, we need to stop thinking of candidates as a man in a suit and think of think of candidates as, you know, everything our country has to offer. And that's women like you who have run and gotten elected and gotten a lot of work done and things like that. So that's what we do at Emily's List.
Absolutely. And we're going to touch on a couple of those things that you talked about later on in the interview. So I appreciate you kind of prefacing, you know, some of the things that women candidates have to deal with. You and Stephanie Shriok wrote the book Run to Win, and I want to write a book one day as well. But I'm just curious, like, what made you decide to write this book?
You know, it started during the 2018 cycle, which, as you know, as someone who was elected in that cycle, was something different, right? We'd seen the election of Donald Trump. We'd seen the Women's March. We'd seen women come out in droves to be activists, to be candidates, to do all of those things. Not that they weren't before, but in greater number. We like to say, you know, it's perhaps the only good thing that Donald Trump gave us was that all of this sort of imposter syndrome and the doubt that you could look and say, if that guy can be president, you better believe I can, you know, do a better job in office. So we're mildly grateful for that and nothing else, right? But in watching that cycle and seeing all of the amazing women running, Stephanie Shriok, who was at the time our president of Emily's List, said, you know, I want to get this all down, right? I want to be able to share what we've seen in this cycle, but also what we've learned along the way at Emily's List. And as we started talking about it and we started writing it, it became sort of a guide. And the idea is that it can provide women with guidance on running for office, but also just being a leader. You know, whether that's in your own life or in your own community or of a group or, you know, all sorts of things. And so the book was really meant to take all of the things that we have learned through years of training women and watching women run and apply that to any woman who wants to change the world.
I love it. I love it. So the book tells stories of a lot of remarkable women. And so, you know, as you're writing this book, what's one story that really stuck out to you, or one that you find yourself kind of going back to when you need a little inspiration?
You know, if you ask me on any given day, I might give you a different story. The reality is, what I love about my job is that the women that I get to work for and work with are so inspiring. So I look at, you know, one that really sticks out to me is the story of Lauren Underwood. She's a nurse. She was a healthcare policy analyst. And, you know, God forbid we get one of those in Congress. And she was someone who started running because she went to a town hall that her congressman had, and he promised that he would not vote for anything that would undermine coverage for people with pre-existing conditions. Lauren has a pre-existing condition. And then he did exactly that. And Lauren said, okay, I'm going to fix it. But she also went in and in her first week got changes made in the sexual harassment policies in Congress. You know, in the weeks since, she has passed healthcare policy after healthcare policy. She has drawn attention to things like our Black maternal mortality crisis, you know, and she was, I think, the youngest Black woman ever elected to Congress. She is, she's just a badass, pardon my French. And so she's one example. There are so many others, and it's just inspiring.
Absolutely. I love Lauren. So I have not actually had an opportunity to just really sit down and have a conversation with Lauren, but I've been to several events where Lauren was a speaker, so I knew that story. And she was running in 2018 at the same time that I was running in 2018. And even though we were both running, she was inspiring me as a candidate. So I really appreciate everything that she has done. Lauren's an amazing person. So women are judged unfairly, literally everywhere. But in politics, it feels like it can be even worse than usual. And so what are some examples of the misogyny that's built into our systems? And do you have any suggestions or strategies that we can use to rise above the misogyny?
Great question. I'm not here to tell you I have all the solutions, sadly, but we're working on it. I think so. Some of the things that are built in, there are overt things. You know, women, and I don't have to tell you this. Women in politics, women online, women influencers, women reporters. Study after study will tell you they get more abuse on social media. Right, their abuse is more gendered. You know, men might get criticized for a policy position they take. Women get criticized for that and what they wore, and that they're a woman daring to speak out, that they're, you know, that they're too loud, that they're not loud enough, that they're too meek, that they're, you know, you name it, they get all of that. But, you know, the more we see women in charge, the more we see women in legislative bodies like you, the more we are able to associate leader with woman, but we're not quite there yet. But the other thing I would say, I mentioned the abuse online. Disinformation is a major issue, and it is far online, and it is far worse for women. And that tends to swamp out everything else. And the problem is, and I am guilty of this, as I suspect are many of your viewers, we see something outrageous, we want to call it out, right? The reality, and that's important, and we should always call out racism and sexism and all of that, but we also have to make sure that we are lifting up the positive things that the women do.
Right. Because
what happens is when men don't face those things, then we can just talk about the stuff they get done. Well, women are getting just as much, if not more, done. But we're too busy fighting the racism and the sexism to say, oh, but also she passed this bill, she got this done, she had this hearing, and we need to do more of that. And so what I would say is to all of your listeners, make a goal for yourself that every time I post on something outrageous, and there's a lot of outrage out there, I'm also going to find something great that a woman in office has done, and I'm going to post about that. And I'm going to flood the zone a little bit with that.
I love that strategy. And that kind of brings me to my next question. So we do have women out there that will defend. And, you know, they spend a lot of time defending, you know, women and trying to call out misinformation, disinformation, or bad faith memes, racism, sexism, misogyny. But we also know that sometimes women can be other women's harshest critics as well. Why is it so important that we prioritize supporting other women? Why do we need to really put supporting other women at the top of our list?
I think it's a couple of reasons. Number one, and this is, I truly believe this, this is about leveling the playing field, right? We're not saying we want, you know, I'm not saying you can never criticize a woman in power. Absolutely we should, right? Yes, you know, I'll do it with people in my own party, you know, and women who I love. But if they do something wrong, yes, you know, that's what women in power, I think, want. But they want to be criticized on the merits of what they do and not based on their gender, not based on I'm a mom, you know, or I'm not a mom, or, you know, so on and so forth. And so if we want a level playing field, then we need to be willing to support women in ways that get them there. We also need to be willing to call it out when it happens, even to people we don't like. And I, this happened this week, you know, Elise Stefanik, who I suspect is a, you know, GOP House leader and big supporter of Donald Trump. And I suspect we disagree on just about everything, but she is going to have a baby, and her local news did this whole thing about will she still be able to serve. It's a 4-minute piece about is, and so let's criticize her absolutely for her positions, but for the idea that she can't, you know, that she might not be as available, well, there are plenty of men who skip votes, you know, like this is, that's ridiculous. And so I think number one is we want a level playing field, and number two is because we have seen now what women in power do, how much they get done, how successful they are. Stacey Abrams lost an election, and what does she do? She went and she started fighting for, you know, fighting for the right to vote, fighting for a fair census count. She put that all of that to work. Kamala Harris is already doing amazing work in the legislature. Women get things done, and they need to be there because that's how our views are represented. The reality is when we're not at, you know, it's Cecile Richards used to say it, when we're not at the table, we're on the menu. And so we need to make sure that we are making a conscious effort to support women because our systems are not built for us. So we have to change that ourselves.
Absolutely. I 100% agree with you. Everything about this interview is just resonating with me so much as someone who, you know, sits in a position, an elected office, and worries about, you know, the small things. Very few people will actually attack me on any policy that I put forth, because I'm not putting forth bad policy, but they will, you know, find a bad picture of me and put it on a campaign flyer. So when women run, when a woman runs for office, we often hear, oh, I'll vote for a woman, but just not that woman. So you've worked with Kamala Harris and you've worked with Hillary Clinton. So I'm sure you've heard that plenty of times. So what do you think our response should be when we hear people say things like that?
I think that we need to ask people, what do you think is driving that? Right? What do you think is driving your dislike of them? You know, and here's the thing. We saw this a lot, you know, when I worked for Hillary Clinton, and we heard a lot, I'll vote for a woman, but not her. When Elizabeth Warren runs, I'm all in. And obviously, Elizabeth Warren is not president, you know, that a lot of those same people then turned and said, well, just not her. Maybe when AOC runs, then I'll be all in. And what I think you need to ask people to do is to take a step back and say, okay, the criticisms that you're making of this woman, would you make of a man? I worked with a group called We've Got Her Back before they named Kamala Harris, just to say, hey, they're going to name a woman. You need to treat her fairly. And Valerie Jarrett, who's a part of that, noted this. And I think it's such a simple way of looking at it. Would I criticize a man for the same thing? When we talk about women having families or not having families, when we talk about the way that, you know, the way they parent, the way they got to, you know, to them. We saw this a lot with Kamala Harris when people criticized her ambition. And my first thought was, she wants to be the president of the United States. I hope she has ambition, right? Like, I certainly hope she has big dreams. And that's something, do we ever criticize a man for ambition?
No.
And so that's something that I would ask people to do, is just in your own head, take a step back and say, is this a criticism I would level against a man? And if it isn't, then you need to do some real thinking about it. We convince ourselves that it's not about gender. My friend Jennifer Palmieri used to say this. We worked for Hillary together, and she said, people would always say, there's just something about her I just don't like. And, you know, we heard that a lot, and no one could put their finger on what the something was. And what we realized, particularly as multiple women ran for president later, was that just something was kind of her gender.
Yes.
You know, there's lots of reasons to support different candidates. I'm not saying you must support the woman at all times, but I'm saying, please acknowledge if your thinking is based on, this isn't what I'm used to. And I think we would all do a lot better and get better candidates if we didn't, you know, keep those sort of blinders on.
Right. I agree 100%. Okay. So now we're going to jump into some fun rapid fire questions. First question, what sitcom character do you think would make the best politician?
That's a good question. I love a good sitcom. You know, I think there's an obvious answer, which is Leslie Knope, who did run for, you know, I loved Parks and Rec, right? Leslie ran for office and God bless her. But I'm going to pick somebody different from that show, which is Ann Perkins, her best friend. Ann was a nurse. Again, God forbid we get some healthcare policy up in government. But also she was someone who started the show by going to a community meeting and demanding action on something. And I think what we're seeing right now, you know, we saw it very powerfully last week with Cori Bush. We're seeing activists run for office and take that activism into legislatures and into Congress. And so I think Ann Perkins would be a great person to put on a ballot somewhere.
Yes. All right. So the Olympics are over now, but if you could compete in any Olympic event, what would it be?
Well, I took gymnastics as a kid, and I would say pretty okay at it, except I didn't like going backwards. I was a little afraid, you know, of not being able to see the ground. But it would probably have to be gymnastics. Also, I mean, Simone Biles is such a hero right now for everything she's bringing up and the way she's standing up. I think little girls all want to be Simone Biles, but so does this big girl.
I love it. Simone Biles is like one of my personal heroes. Mine would be track, but I also did gymnastics, and I'm also afraid of going backwards. So I never learned how to do anything backwards, back handsprings, back flips, none of that stuff. My event was a balance beam, and I just did a bunch of cartwheels and round offs on there. And so, all right. So what do you do when you need to get rid of excess rage?
You know, this is where, and we talk in the book about support systems. I get on with a good girlfriend, you know, and I have a number of them who will just let me rant for a minute and then will divert the conversation to something happier, you know? So that's what I do.
Mine is blasting music and singing at the top of my lungs. Like, I'm just like, music is like my therapy. All right. So if you were running for office, what song would you play to kick off a big speech?
It's a good question. I've thought about that a lot. I will say in my grumpier days, it's Not Ready to Make Nice by the Dixie Chicks. When I feel like I need to sort of rage against the machine. I'm a very big Bruce Springsteen song fan. My dog is named Rosalita after one of his songs. Probably Land of Hope and Dreams by Bruce Springsteen.
I love that. So that is actually the end of our rapid fire questions and of our interview today. And I really, really appreciate you coming on here and just talking about running for office and all that Emily's List does for women candidates. So where can people find more about you and your work online?
Sure. It's Emily's List website is a great resource. It's emilyslist.org. You can actually buy the book there if you'd like to. You can also buy it at bookstores around the country. I am on Twitter at CReynoldsNC for my home state. And we're on all the socials as some version of Emily's List. I hope people will follow. We do some, we try and lift up different candidates and things like that. So we try and provide you some of that good content if you're looking for it. But I also want to say, Jasmine, thank you for everything you all do. This podcast is fantastic, and it takes so much, it takes a lot of guts to run for office and to stay in it when it can be tough. And I know in a place like Georgia, sometimes it's hard. Some of the guys in power are not doing the right thing. And so grateful to have women like you in there fighting the good fight. And so thank you for everything that you do.
Oh, well, thank you very much. That actually means a lot. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. This is great. I really appreciate you coming on and for being here with us on the Suburban Women Problem.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Welcome back, everyone. Jasmine, it was so great to hear your interview with Christina. I am a big Emily's List fan. I think our political system, I think about it as a fixer-upper. And so Emily's List is like the Joanna Gaines of politics. Little sprucing up that we need to do right there.
Oh, I love that, Amanda. Yeah, Jasmine, awesome interview. It was really special for me in particular. The reason is because I worked with Christina on a campaign over 15 years ago. And yeah, and reconnected with her recently. And guess what we talked about the entire time as we reconnected? Being women in politics, the need for women to support each other. And so just hearing you all talk and just hearing that play out and having her here, that was really special for me. Thank you.
Absolutely. I appreciate Christina so much. I appreciate Emily's List amazingly. I was an Emily's List endorsed candidate. So I know firsthand that Emily's List supports women candidates, helps us with so much more than might even meet the eye. So we have now gotten to the point of our pod where we do our toast to joy. This is where we toast to something great that's happened in our lives, that's happening in the world. And so, Katie, let's start with you. What is your toast to joy this week?
So recently I got to take a family trip to a lake house. And what we do at the lake house is we water ski.
Fun.
I just got to make water skiing my toast to joy this week because of what we've been talking about. I think so much of what, you know, I'm hearing from your experience, Jasmine, and Meredith echoed this too, is that I think maybe some of the unlearning happens by just being fearless. when I am out there, I'm going fast. I feel, you know, strong in my whole body and I feel fearless. And I just want to think about holding on to that feeling in other aspects of my life.
I've never been water skiing. I'm going to have to try it. I've like watched it and I'm like, that looks like it would be really fun, but I've never actually been. So,
okay. Well, this lake house is in Georgia.
Oh.
So this is happening.
I will make the trip to do water skiing for the first time since I know I'm in good company and that you actually know what you're doing, because I am going to probably be horrified.
And it's this great way, like, you're going to fall. Like, get over it. You're going to fall. You're not going to get up the first time. Just fall on your face and you get back up again. You'll do it.
Yep.
So my toast to joy this week is actually learning new things. So not about water skiing, because I haven't learned that yet. But my daughter just started. She made the volleyball team at her school. And so I actually don't know that much about the game of volleyball. It's just something that she wanted to do. She tried out for the team. She made it. And so she's never played volleyball either. So we're both learning this together. So she's teaching me all the things that she's learning in volleyball practice about how to hit the ball and how to turn her wrist and how to serve. And I love experiencing new things, even if I am not the one experiencing it. Like, my daughter experiencing new things still opens up my world, because again, now I get a whole new game that I get to experience. So it's going to be fun. I'm looking forward to the first game and just seeing how things go. She got her uniform already, and yeah,
you better text us. Tell us how it goes.
I will definitely let y'all know how it goes, and I'm excited. I feel like I'm going to be that parent in the stand that's like, go, and they're like, no, that wasn't good. I'm like, oh, sorry. I thought that was a good thing. My bad.
I love that. We love experiencing new things. So my toast to joy, kind of similar, is so we went on vacation, a little road trip to someplace we'd never been before. So one of our favorite vacations is just going someplace new, experiencing a new place. And so my toast to joy is to new places.
Love it. All right. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining us. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a rating and a review. We'll see you again next week on another episode of The Suburban Women Problem.
The Suburban Women Problem was created by Red, Wine, and Blue. Our executive producer is Beverly Batt. Our producer and editor is Amy Thorstenson, and our video producer is Ashley Hufford. If you're ready to be part of the Suburban Women Problem, head over to redwine.blue and sign up for our newsletter so you don't miss a thing.